The Natural Hat Trick, hosted by Luke Lipinski and Craig Morgan.
Welcome into episode 270 of the Natural Hat Trick podcast alongside Craig Morgan.
Natty Hattie.
I'm Luke Lipinski. Craig, how are you doing today?
Okay, hiding my bedhead behind this beautiful Wisconsin beanie. Don't tell Greg Powers.
I'm going to have to tell Greg Powers. I'm sorry. You'll be interested to know they are jackhammering in the street right out in front of my house for what I'm
pretty sure. That's good.
Okay. Well, I can. I'm pretty sure it's for no reason at all. I think they just have extra jackhammers they want to play with on this fine Friday morning.
They got a copy of our schedule.
Yeah. They did start about 20 minutes before. Actually, that's not true. They originally started at 5 in the morning, which was cute. And then they stopped for a while and started. I think they were just waiting for us to record. And so if they make an appearance, here we go.
Where do you draw the line, by the way, when workers come to do something loud in the street or next door? Where do you draw? What's the time? Because we get landscapers who like wait for the first light of day and then decide it's OK to operate their, you know, gas powered tools in the park behind us.
I would say sometime later than whenever these guys started. I'm a big fan of like leaf blower guy that doesn't really work for anybody, that just stands outside your window and just like points the thing right at your window for an hour and a half till you come out and wave to him. I think it has to be after 6 or 7.
Well, that's not happening around here sometimes when it's summer and they're trying to get in while it's still cool. But
that's true.
I kind of feel like 7 o'clock should be the, maybe for landscapers, 6 o'clock, because they've got a lot to do. They probably have other jobs, but man, like when I'm hearing something at 5:30 in the morning, I have a problem with that.
Well, it should be later on Sundays too, like on the weekends, but I'm on board with the, like, if you're a landscaper, you're going to be out in the heat all day. I totally get it. Like, and plus landscapers aren't usually that loud, but it's February and you're jackhammering a hole in the street that will probably prevent me from pulling out of my driveway anyway. And I'm not really sure what you're doing. You wait till 6.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into some of the hockey. We've got the Coyotes are basically a third of the way through the season, just a little bit over that. We'll get into a lot of listener questions too, but I want to start with the story you wrote on AZ Coyotes Insider. Why don't you just tell us about how this came to be? Because I didn't know you were writing it, and then one day it just popped up in my feed, and I was like, well, haven't seen this one written anywhere.
No, I had representatives from Mitchell Miller reach out and ask if I'd be willing to interview him, and of course, there was a whole lot of trepidation there. We all know the details of the case. We know the state of race relations in America and a lot of other issues in America, bullying in America. I had a lot of hesitancy when deciding whether I would write this story, but I did provide a lot of conditions under which the interview would even happen. I still didn't know if I would write a story. I think I outlined most of those in the story. Did want someone on the line coaching him. He had to answer all of my questions. I wanted to reach out to the victim's family as well, which I did. The mother gave me something short, but told me that Isaiah Meyer Crothers is not doing interviews and she wanted to keep her comments brief as well. So I got in from her what I could in that story, but you know, he agreed to all of those conditions and I conducted the interview. But even after that, Luke, look, I don't think I've really hidden my views on politics and the situation in America on this podcast. I think most people know that I'm a liberal and this was a tough story for me to even think about writing. I counseled a lot of people. I counseled 6 people in total before writing it, 3 of whom have more than 100 years of journalism experience between them. Everyone agreed that it was a legitimate news story if it was handled the right way. And several of these people even edited it for me to see the finished product. I also counseled my wife, who is my moral compass in life and has a better moral compass than anyone I know. So I wrote the story and clearly I knew ahead of time that there was going to be a wide range of opinions on this story. And that has been the case both in the comments section on the site and then, of course, on Twitter, which can be a brutal place.
Yes, Twitter absolutely can. And I've read the story. You know, I think what stood out, and I won't even get so much into the story. Like you said, most people know the backstory and I'm not sure how I feel about Mitchell Miller. I am. And it's not, I don't hold him in a very high opinion. Let's just put it that way. But yeah. I do think there is something to second chances. I'm not saying that he's at a place where he deserves. I don't know him. I've never talked to him. I'm not going to sit here and render judgment on him or even the situation. I'll just say, I think sometimes we're too quick to say, no, you don't get a second chance to everything. Like, there are different levels of stuff, but I would also say, and this is, I feel like gets lost a lot. Second chance doesn't mean you get to play in the NHL and make millions of dollars. Yes. There's a difference between what this guy did was absolutely reprehensible to the point where we won't even discuss it on this show. But and when he was 14, and if he takes the steps for years and years and years to try and get his life back on track, okay. I mean, you shouldn't just be done at 14, I guess, depending what you did. And again, I don't think I know all the details, but I don't think he ever needs to play in the NHL. There's a ton of people out there who are good enough to play in the NHL who didn't get opportunities because their parents didn't have money, because they were hurt growing up, because they just didn't, you know, whatever. There's a lot of people in the AHL that are close to playing and don't get to play. So I think there's a difference in second chance between, okay, you know, your life shouldn't be over at 14, but you don't need to make millions of dollars playing hockey either. And I'm not saying that he can never get to that point. Like I said, I think that sometimes we don't draw that line. We're like, well, second chance means he gets to be playing in the All-Star game next year.
Yeah, I have a real problem with, you know, the people in Mitchell Miller's camp who say that he's lost everything. He hasn't lost everything. He's lost hockey. That's it. Yeah. There are plenty of options still open to Mitchell Miller. Playing in the NHL, or really playing hockey, period, is a privilege. And that's how it should be viewed at this point. It should be viewed as that by just about anybody. It's not a right. So he hasn't lost everything. He has a lot of options. I also dismiss those who write this off as the act of a 14-year-old. Most 14-year-olds know not to do what he did. You know right from wrong when you're 14. It's not like you're 6 years old. This was an
Say most 6-year-olds know not to do what he did, too.
This was an inexcusable act, so let's not paint it as anything but that, okay? Let's start with those 2 points. At the same time, I really struggle with this idea that he doesn't deserve a voice. He doesn't deserve to speak anymore. I don't think this is the same thing as a Tony D'Angelo. This is not an adult we're talking about, first of all. If you have a history of behavior as an adult, we can talk. I think that's in a different category, and we can talk about that. I would have a much greater problem with that. I still have enormous problems with what he did. But again, I struggle with the idea that he doesn't deserve to talk about this. Yes, he does. The incident itself is above analysis, but, you know, and some, by the way, some have asked why I didn't ask about what happened in that incident. As a parent, I can tell you the answer. You don't ask your kids why they engaged in abhorrent behavior. That allows for the possibility that there was a reason for it. There's no good reason for what he did. It's about accountability from that point forward, and it's about teaching them why it was so wrong and how they can learn and grow from it. So as a kid, do we not give him a chance? I think this is a legitimate news story. Multiple people that I consulted with a lot of experience in this industry agreed with me. And as I said, edited it.
Yeah. And I think I can even probably draw distinctions there too. I'm not sure that I want to give him another chance, but I think from your perspective of writing the story, if you're a journalist and there's new news out there on an important subject, you know, I'm not going to say it's your responsibility to put it out there, but it kind of is your job to put, I mean, that's what journalism is. So, you know, I think when you allow somebody, and I'm sure I didn't read your comments, I'm sure you got some pushback on it. And I understand that, honestly, but I think when you're giving somebody like that a voice, it's not, okay, I'm giving this person a voice to help them look better. There were things in there he said where I'm like, man, you are still playing the victim. There were things in there he said that's like, okay, I haven't heard this. I didn't know he was doing this and this, but there are times, like you just said, where he was kind of like, and I've lost everything over this. Like, you did this, man. I don't feel bad for you at all.
Yeah. And his mom made that point. You know, there are a lot of people saying, why are you ruining his life? Well, it was Mitchell who committed the act. Yeah. He's the one who did this to Isaiah. So yeah, accountability is important. And that was a big idea with the story. Okay. Let's let him speak and let's let readers form their judgments. At the same time, there are a lot of snap judgments off this story and the previous ones that have said he's not contrite. He's not doing enough. I interviewed Mitchell Miller for 30 minutes. First of all, I'll tell you some details of the interview. This was not polished. He stammered. He was clearly emotional. There were points where he was embarrassed, but that doesn't say anything. After 30 minutes, I don't know if Mitchell Miller is contrite or not. Yeah. Nobody does, but Mitchell Miller and maybe a few people close to him. So all the, you know, the internet people who are saying, yeah, he's not contrite enough. I don't like what he's saying. I don't think his words. Okay, you can have that opinion, but you don't know. You absolutely do not know. And stop pretending that you do. None of us do. But again, I thought it was worth hearing what he had to say, putting it all out there and let people decide for themselves. I set parameters for the article. And then again, just put it out there, let people hear what he has to say and then decide. I do think this is a legitimate news story.
Yeah, well, because he absolutely could say stuff that makes himself look worse. And, yes. And you know, and that was very much a possibility. And I think there are a couple parts in there where I don't want to say it makes him look worse because the original act, he's not going to be able to surpass that for just truly terribleness. But, you know, there were certain points in there, like I said, where he says stuff and you're like, okay, this is still a, I mean, you can tell he's still a teenager. And you're like, okay, this guy's got more maturing to do than most people do at this age. But is he trying? If he's trying, then, you know, again, he should be able to mature, but that doesn't mean he gets to play in the NHL. But then there are other parts where it felt like he still, even if it was only 15, 20% where he still kind of feels like he's a victim in this, it's that's not it, man. You're 0% the victim.
I get that, but that's also what made this interview more real to me. It wasn't polished where he was saying all the right things. He was still thinking of himself, and what teenager doesn't think of themselves, to be honest? That's a big problem with teenage years. They're self-indulgent. They're self-absorbed.
Yeah.
So it was a very real interview to me. A couple of things before we move on. One of the things that has troubled me from the beginning, and I've mentioned this before on the podcast, I was reporting on this story when other outlets were also reporting on this story. I am an army of one versus multiple, though, so it was harder. When those reports came out, I had heard some things, and I continued to do some reporting. I'm not comfortable with the reporting to date on this story, Luke. I think there's a lot that has been missed, and I think there, yeah, I would just say, I'll put it like that. I think there is a lot that has been missed on this story. One of the things that came out in this story itself, I got a hold of the letter that he wrote to serve as an apology to Isaiah. There is a legal document, part of public record, that says he read it to Isaiah and it was also sent to the family. This letter was, and this whole process was witnessed by multiple school officials. And yet the mother is saying the letter was never read. As a journalist, the only logical conclusion that you can reach there when you have multiple people from the district telling you that this did happen and it's part of a legal record, I have to question the mother's credibility on this. I have to, as a journalist. I don't know if she's being truthful on this part of the story. Again, I got legal documents. And then with what he's done since, a lot of people say he hasn't done enough. Oh, he only did what the courts asked him to do in terms of community service. Well, he did the 25 hours of community service. And if you look at what he did, it touched a lot of bases, from working with disabled kids, working with minorities, and talking about anti-bullying in schools. The latter came after his community service had ended. When he got to junior hockey, he was doing that in Cedar Rapids. You can say, okay, well, he was doing that because the coach asked him to. Okay, you know, was it legitimate? Was it heartfelt? I don't know. Again, I don't know Mitchell Miller's heart, but all kids need direction from adults on what to do. I mean, you can't just say, hey, go out there and talk about anti-bullying, kid, and figure it out. No kid's going to be able to figure out. You have to give them structure. But the fact that he was doing these things, both through the court mandates and then beyond that, in the years afterward, at the very least, it put him in an environment where he could learn and grow from that. He was being exposed to ideas that he probably hadn't been exposed to before. And I have talked to people who really think they made an impact, and not just coaches. It's not just coaches. It's people that are experts in the field that think it made an impact. Does that mean that he is contrite? Again, I do not know. I don't know Mitchell Miller's heart, but there's a lot more to this story that I think has not been reported.
It is a mess. I'm sure that was a difficult story to write. I'm sure, like you said, you wrestled with even taking the call. It's a mess, and it's all of his doing. So that's the thing where I'm just kind of like, when there's any sort of hint that it's like, oh, why am I still going through this? You're going through this because you put everybody through it. And to me, it's, you know, there's not a clean end to the story. I mean, maybe someday him and Isaiah sit down 10, 15 years from now, I don't know. And Isaiah's like, all right, you know, that to me is when he says he's kind of ready to move forward. You know, he's the only one that was truly affected by this. Like, I mean, his family too. So, Yes. Yeah, I don't know. It's just so complicated and such a mess. And it goes so far past hockey. We really haven't even talked about hockey yet.
No. Yeah, exactly. We know the state of race relations in America. We've seen them exacerbated over the last 4 years. So it's such a hot button issue. Right. But again, as you mentioned earlier, I wonder, when are we even open to the idea of forgiveness for people? You see this all over the American penal system. As a culture, we don't seem interested in rehabilitation, only continuing punishment. Again, I don't know if Miller has reached the point where he even deserves that. And that's not up for me to decide. But I do find that aspect of our culture deeply troubling.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole different conversation now in the age of social media, where people, and I'm not talking about this case, I'm just talking in general, there is that like rush to judgment when you don't know all the facts.
Yeah.
But I also feel like even like 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, people weren't really held accountable when they did some terrible stuff. So in that respect, it's good. I just don't know how far it goes. You know what I mean? So we'll see.
Well, the key point you made there is that too many people form judgments without enough information.
Yeah.
And that's again, going back to reporting more details of this story, I don't think nearly enough of this story is out. So it's really hard to form judgments at this point.
I think the important thing from my perspective, reading it and knowing that you know, were kind of wrestling with writing it, I never once read the story and was like, oh, okay. And Craig's kind of like, let's put a bow on this and now move forward. And oh, I feel like there was never any sort of tone of like, and now, you know, now it's time to move. There was none of that. I feel like that was just a very factual based story. Not really any emotion injected into it by the writer, which in this case was you, but it's an emotional story to read. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I hope so, because that was my attempt, at least, to be neutral. And that's why I enlisted some people that I really respect to help me with the writing of this and the editing of this story. There are going to be people, like you said, there are going to be people out there who say, oh, you just gave him a platform for his redemption story. Okay, some people are going to react that way, but that was not my intent. And in my own heart, I don't think that's what I did.
Yeah. All right. Let's get to actual hockey, and we'll start. Let's start with Montreal firing their coach and assistant coach, which, you know, we've talked on this podcast on a few times throughout the offseason. And then since the season has begun, I don't want to put words in your mouth. I was not nearly as high on Montreal, I don't think you were, as a lot of people were. I mean, I saw them being picked to win that division before the season. And so, you know, over the last couple of weeks, the flip side to that is when we get listener questions, they're like, which team has surprised you, or which team were you the most wrong on? The only team I feel like I was wrong on this year is Montreal is better than I thought they would be. And they were 9-4 and 5 when they fired Claude Julien. So if you're better than I think you are, and then you fire your coach, I really don't know what they're doing. Do they think they're going to like challenge for the Stanley Cup this year? They were the 24th team in the playoffs last year, and they only beat Pittsburgh because Pittsburgh melts down in the playoffs now.
I think they have unrealistic expectations of who they are. And when you look at all the moves that ownership made or approved to make in the offseason, yeah, I think they expected more because they made so many moves. But when you analyze the roster, I don't know, man, I'm seeing the same thing you're seeing. Right now they're in fourth place in that division. That still, to me, is a generous place for them. I don't think they're the fourth best team in that division, even with all the moves they made in the offseason. So I don't know. This felt like, it felt unfair.
I feel like we knew stuff like this was going to happen. We knew teams, sure. That division is loaded with teams who either the team and or their media and or their fan base all overvalue what they have on their roster, or, you know what I mean? Like Vancouver, we talk about a ton as being like, they think they're a cup contender. They're only ahead of Ottawa in that division. Montreal, it seems to think they're a cup contender. And I think they're overachieving where they are right now. Or, you know, I can come around enough to look and say the additions of guys like Tyler Toffoli were big. Maybe fourth place in that division is where they should be. But I'm not firing my coach if he's a few games above 500. He was four games above 500, and they had only played 18 games in a division where, I don't know, I'm starting to like that division more and more just because they are all so insane about their teams, and it all gets ramped up that much more when they're playing other Canadian teams.
Yeah, and I wonder if that plays into it too, right? You're in an all-Canadian division, so there's some serious bragging rights there, right? If they slip out of the playoffs, it's not a good look, even if you're, you know, if you're being realistic, you look at Montreal and say, yeah, at best, they're a bubble playoff team, but there's some factors here creating unrealistic expectations for the Canadiens.
I thought it was interesting. I want to make sure. I think it was Jeff Merrick and Justin Bourne I heard talking about this, and they said one factor to consider is maybe not just because it's all Canadian teams, but also maybe Montreal looks around and says, this may be our best chance to make the playoffs for a while. Because in theory, you're going back in a division with Tampa and Boston and Florida on the rise and still Toronto next year. Whereas maybe they look around and say, other than Toronto, who looks consistent in this division? So maybe they're just like, we got to push all our chips in, go for it now. On top of that, how much more Carey Price do you have? Shea Weber. Carey Price hasn't even been that great this year, but there's maybe some logic to that. I'm just not sure I'm making that move.
What do you make of Edmonton then? I mean, they have the two of the five best players in the world right now, and they're both playing like it. And Edmonton is surging right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I think Toronto and Edmonton are the clear class of that division. But at the same time, Connor McDavid's only been to the playoffs once. So until I see them actually get in the playoffs and do something, I'm not going to put a lot of stock in the Oilers. But yeah, I mean, Montreal being ahead of Calgary and Vancouver, it wouldn't have shocked me at the start of the season if they finished sixth. And in fact, I think when we picked our order for this division, I think I had Montreal sixth based on what they've done
out of the playoffs. I know that I had them out of the playoffs. I had obviously Ottawa out of the playoffs. I'm trying to remember the third team that I picked to miss the playoffs. It may have been Winnipeg, but.
Well, yeah, because it is sort of a toss up. I mean, if you're just going by talent, it's Toronto and Edmonton. And then there is kind of just a, you know, Vancouver, Winnipeg, Calgary. And oh, no, now
it,
Montreal.
It was Vancouver, actually. Vancouver. I was with Jamie on nonlinear progression, and thus far, it's proven true.
They have been the definition of nonlinear progression.
Quinn Hughes will lead the league in points by a defenseman and also lead the league in points allowed by a defenseman.
Yeah, nobody ever looks at that second stat, do they?
They're looking at it this year.
Yeah, I bet.
finally noticing that Quinn Hughes cannot defend.
Yeah, it's in that market, if you're not winning, all of a sudden the scrutiny is there. If you're winning, they overlook a lot, which, you know, it's what it's all about if you're a fan. But if you are media or if you're running a team, especially, and you have to make tough decisions, you got to be honest about yourself with what you have. Yeah. That is a fun division, though. Anything else around the league before we get into the Coyotes you wanted to touch on?
No, that was the one thing, actually. I just wanted to touch on the North Division because it has been so much fun. There's so much offense. There's so many talented offensive players in that division that – they're exciting games.
One last thing, actually, from that group. Auston Matthews, 18 goals in 21 games.
Are you following Myrtle's like nightly tweets? Like, yeah. Auston Matthews is now on pace for this many goals in this many games. I say he does it. He keeps saying it's hilarious to watch.
He does. It makes me wish this was an 82-game season, just because I do wonder, you know, if he's scoring at this pace, he's not gonna be able to keep it up over 82 games, but I mean, I could do the math quickly right now that would put him on pace for like a 70 goal season. Like, that would be unreal. I do wonder this, and I don't want to take away from it. And I'm actually just having this thought for the first time now. So I'm not saying that there is or isn't the right answer to this, but do you think if they were playing, if this was a normal season and he was playing all 30 other teams, he would still be scoring like this?
Probably not, because there's more travel involved to farther locales. There'd probably be a little more fatigue. But I don't know, actually, because you can make a flip side argument that these teams know what to do to defend Auston Matthews after watching him. So they should have a better chance of stopping him. So I don't know. Maybe he's just this ridiculously good. I kind of think the latter, actually. I think he's this good.
I think he is too. Cause like my thought is, okay, but if he had to play Vegas a couple of times, maybe he's not scoring in those games, but then that's also, he's playing Detroit a couple of times,
division, right?
Yeah. But that release is just so, it's not just a great release on his shot. It's a very deceptive release on his shot. As a goalie, he's got to be the guy. As a defender, you look and you're like, I don't want to see Connor McDavid coming up the ice. You don't even have time to think that, cause he's already passed you. But as a goalie, I have to think that Auston Matthews is at the top of the list of guys you don't want to face, just because he makes them look so foolish so often. And these are the best goalies in the world. All right. So I mentioned the Coyotes are a third of the way through the season now at 9-7-3 on the year. Currently, I guess, technically tied in points with LA for third in the division. LA, who, by the way, seems to be getting it together about 2 years ahead of when I thought they would.
Well, speaking of nonlinear progression, but go ahead.
Yeah, that's true. They are a weird one, too. We saw them a couple times last week since our last podcast. It's not like all their young players that everybody's excited about are doing anything other than, like, Gabriel Velarde's been decent. I mean,
no, it's just Dustin Brown is going to win the Rocket Richard Trophy this year. It's just
yeah. We watched them play the Coyotes, and it was Dustin Brown, Drew Doughty, Anze Kopitar, and Jonathan Quick that beat them one night. And then it was those like three guys.
Back to 2012.
Oh, that second game too, where they were just beating up on Connor Garland, and yeah, it's probably a good thing there weren't a full house of fans for that second one, because Dustin Brown definitely took some liberties there that seemed familiar. But it is crazy. You're right. He's scoring, and it's the same guys that led the Kings to success like 8 years ago that are doing it right now. So in that respect, I don't think this guarantees they're going to be good next year or anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Does this further than that? Does this concern you if you're the Kings? Cause you're okay. Great. Your veterans are leading the way and you want them to, you know, shepherd the young guys to NHL adulthood, but Kopitar, Brown, Doughty, Carter, those are four of your top five scorers right now. Kopitar has 21 points in 18 games. Dustin Brown has 11 goals. These are not young guys. Dustin Brown is 36. Kopitar is 33. Doughty is 31 with a lot of mileage on his body. These guys aren't going to be around in a couple of years. So are your young guys actually stepping up, or is this, I don't know, is this a mirage?
And the goaltending, I mean, Calvin Peterson has been better than Quick, just in terms of goals against average, save percentage, all that stuff. And there's a ton of different ways, and probably better ways, honestly, to measure a goalie. But even the eye test, he has been better overall this season. But we saw it firsthand. When Quick is on, Quick is still probably the better goalie.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Peterson's even the underlying numbers are better. And maybe that's hope for the future as well. But
that's one guy. And honestly, like you talk about the scorers, I mentioned Gabriel Velarde, who's been fine. I mean, he's very, very new to this league, and he's, you can tell he's going to be good. Yeah. Alex Iafallo is the only other one. He's 27. You know, it's not like he's a rookie that's on the way up.
No, he's in his prime right now, approaching the end of his prime. If you look at the analytics on age production now. So again, I don't know if I'd be concerned if I were the Kings, and can these veterans keep up this pace in this crazy condensed schedule, or is that schedule going to get to them? Is LA going to fall off? I don't know, but they are definitely the surprise of the division.
Yeah. I still think this division though, and I doubt anybody's really going to disagree with this, is still Vegas, St. Louis, and Colorado. And Vegas and St. Louis are up there. Colorado just hasn't played. I mean, they've played as many games as Vegas, but they've had sort of a disjointed
percentage right now is not good, but they've been known to have slow starts.
That's true. Although this is later in the calendar year when they were struggling, I guess they're not really struggling right now. Do you think there's anything, we were talking about this the other day in the press box. Do you think there's anything to the notion? We saw the Coyotes come out and not look good against the Kings two games. St. Louis has stumbled out since then. And you know, they both played the Kings. Maybe the Kings are just on a roll. Or do you think there's anything to the notion that playing the same team seven times in the middle of the season took a little bit out of these clubs, even if it was just for a week?
I'm sure it was a combination of a bunch of things. But I do think, listen, first of all, Rick Tocchet didn't mind the Coyotes games against the Kings. He thought they played pretty well. They just didn't finish. But yeah, I think LA is playing very well right now. That's part of it. And yeah, the Coyotes and the Blues probably beat up on each other a little bit, and they sort of got accustomed to playing that style of hockey against each other. It's like coming out of a playoff series, right?
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're in a new team. So yeah, I don't know. We'll see. These things tend to balance out. You know, they call these schedule games when you hit a team that has played a bunch of games, in a very few nights, it can be an advantage for you. But I also think there are scheduled games where you just happen to hit a team when they're hot or when they're cold. And that's what's going on with LA right now. It's like the team that nobody wants to play right now until they cool off again.
Well, the Coyotes have been a very entertaining team this season. and I know you and I talked about this before the season, how it was kind of, it was interesting how people looked, and I don't know if it was a combination of, okay, you lost Taylor Hall, which I understand that, or, you know, where it drove me crazy is it felt like it was a lot of people saying, well, they lost these draft picks the next 2 years. How can they be good this year? Draft picks aren't playing this year. They wouldn't have been playing anyway unless you got the first pick or you took like Tim Stutzel or something. So that doesn't impact this year's team. This year's team is just the same team that made the playoffs last year, minus Taylor Hall, but with a healthy Darcy Kemper, and as it turns out, Dvorak and Chychrun and Garland taking more steps, you know? So to me, it's not a shock they're in a playoff spot. I am a little surprised, though, that they can just fall behind 3-0 in the third period of a game and rattle off 4 goals and win.
Yeah, that's not something we've seen from the Coyotes in the past, and it's a good thing to have. They've actually allowed the first goal in 12 of their 19 games this year, actually come back to win 5 of those and lose 2 more in OT. I wrote a piece just looking at the first third of the season today that just appeared a little while ago on my site. But yeah, I still think that even though they came back from back-to-back 3-goal deficits against Anaheim, which, by the way, is a very bad team, you can't keep doing that. That's not a recipe for success. I think that should be obvious to just about anybody. They have to have better starts. I don't know what the secret is there. We see teams struggle with this. The coach always gets blamed. Sometimes it is the coach's fault, but there are a lot of factors that go into it. They just have to figure that out. But looking at the season to date, you know, the first third of the season, some of the things, I'm curious what you think, but some of the things that jump out at me, I'll start with this. You mentioned that group of fourth and fifth year players. That was the group that Bill Armstrong identified at the start of the season that would sort of set the ceiling for what this club could do this year. So far, most of those guys have contributed. Nick Schmaltz, Christian Dvorak, and Clayton Keller, probably less so. I would say I put those three guys in an elite group, Christian Dvorak, Nick Schmaltz, and Jacob Chychrun. They've all had very good seasons so far. Clayton Keller is coming over his last 9 games. I think he has 9 points. Definitely benefiting from playing on the line he's playing on. And then you've got two guys in Lawson Crouse and Christian Fisher who can't find the back of the net. But overall, this group right now, they've really helped this team take a step. They've really performed as they wanted them to perform.
Yeah, and I just want to be clear for people, you're purposely not including Garland in this group because of when he came into the league.
Yes.
Because people are screaming at their podcasts. Yes.
He deserves his own separate topic anyway.
but yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And Chychrun to me is the most I don't want to say he's the most interesting, but you know, he's the only one out of that group that's a defenseman. We saw him take steps last year, especially offensively. He had 12 goals, which was 11th among NHL defensemen last season. Still very young. I mean, you got to remember, defensemen don't break into the league their draft year. He's one of like the few I can remember other than like Aaron Ekblad over the last 6, 7, 8 years. There might be one or two other ones, but usually draft year, that's not a year that most guys break into their league or into the NHL, especially a defenseman. But then we saw him take a step back in the bubble. Chychrun was not good in the bubble last year, I didn't think. I mean, he kind of tried to get it together. I know he was trying. He kind of got it together a little bit at times, but he was very inconsistent. And then by the last 2 games against Colorado, nobody could do anything. So him taking this step this year is very encouraging because it's not just that he's providing offense. He is a good defensive player too. He's still got, you know, he's still got room to improve. But him and Dvorak in particular out of that group are the most important to me because of the positions they play and how pretty consistent relatively they have been this season. I know Dvorak didn't score there for a little bit, but he was at least doing other stuff.
He was playing too many minutes too. And we can talk about that issue later. But yeah, but I think he's been the most consistent of those forwards.
Too many minutes against Ryan O'Reilly too. A lot of those minutes.
Hard minutes.
I guess if you had to rank them in importance, you'd have to put Keller up there too, just because of how much money you're paying him.
Yes.
And he's been inconsistent, but not as inconsistent as in years past.
Mm-hmm.
I really think it would help. He should just push for playing St. Louis 82 times a year because he finds his game against them. But there are elements to his game that are apparent this year that weren't there in years past. Like he will get back and back check and try and make a play defensively. He's never going to be a great defensive forward, but he's been better at least.
But you can be good in structure, right? And look, I like the fact that Rick Tocchet laid that out when he put these three guys together, Garland, Schmaltz, and Keller on a line. He said, if they don't defend, they're not going to stay together. And for a good stretch, we saw them practicing really good habits away from the puck. They got away from it for a couple games there. You even saw him break them up late in that Anaheim game, the first game, but they're back together. He's going to allow them to grow a little bit. For the most part, they understand that that's the challenge. You guys want to stay together, play on this exciting line and get to play offense a lot. Well, you got to do these things away from the puck. And for the most part, I would say they've risen to the challenge.
Yeah, I would agree. In terms of other forwards that have been a big part of this, we'll get to Garland in a second. What about Phil Kessel, who I think he's been on a roll lately. There was a stretch there where he wasn't really producing. He seems more active away from the puck this season.
Completely agree. Completely agree. There's a jump in him over these last few games that we weren't seeing for that 11-game stretch. Of course, I write a story on him in his offseason regimen because he got off to the hot start with 4 goals in his first 4 games, and then he went to a major slump.
Yeah.
So so I apologize to everyone. I think he had 3 assists during those 11 games and no goals. Rick Tocchet sat down with him. He told me, watched video. Tocchet comes out, or Kessel comes out the next game, and he just had a different jump in his step and a pop in that shot too. And now he's got 6 points in his last 4 games. I mean, this is what they have to have from Phil Kessel. They got to have, he's got to be at least responsible away from the puck too. And that's a lot of what Tocchet talked to him about. But even if you watch his defensive habits over these last few games, he is staying more within their structure. He's staying above his man. He's doing the things that you need to do to be at least competent defensively, which is probably all you can expect from Phil Kessel on that side of the puck. But more importantly, or just as importantly, he's contributing, and they really need him to simply score goals. They have to have goals from someone other than that top line. They have to have goals from Phil Kessel because of what he's getting paid and his role on the team.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that, you know, you're not watching hockey as your job. You just want to watch it casually. You can tell, you could kind of tell this was coming from Kessel because, as you're saying, Craig, he's more structurally sound within the team structure this year, and that's just apparent. You don't have to sit there and break down plays. You can just, are you noticing number 81 on the ice this season? Because in it, last year, you really didn't. Last year it was like, oh yeah, Kessel's on the team, and this year it's like, even if he's not scoring, you're like, oh wait a minute, there he is though. There he's breaking up that pass, or he's you know, he's leading the breakout down the ice or whatever, or he's open for a pass. Like, it's just number 81 is a lot more apparent on the ice. And I would have said that,
as they say, he's dangerous on the ice. Yes.
Exactly. And I would have said that a week ago, but now he's scored a ton too. So that, you know, that sort of emphasizes the point. The goal the other night to ultimately tie that game. I mean, you were there. The feed from Connor Garland was like a shot out of the corner. And Kessel was just like, oh yeah, I'll just put this right in.
That was that, a pass, wasn't it? As soon as that puck came to Keller, and clearly, when you're on the ice, when you're one of those guys that has great vision, you have a sense of where players are on the ice. And so Garland knew that Kessel was going to the net, but he didn't look once he got that puck. He just whipped it in front of the net, and that was it was a terrific pass.
Garland is playing on instinct this year, which is great. That's how you have to play. You have to get to the point where your instincts are correct, and then trust your instincts. And that play is the, if you're a coach trying to teach your kid how to play on instinct, show him that Garland pass, because you're right. He knew Kessel was going there. There was not a like, oh, let me see if I can get this around this defender. There was that confidence of, I'm going to throw this laser. It's going to get around the defender, and it's on Kessel to get a stick on the ice, which he did.
And if he had hesitated for that second to analyze the situation, the play would have been gone.
Yep, 100%. The ability of this team to come back very late in games. It's, you know, I know this is, it's in everybody's mind right now because they've come back from down 3-0 twice this week. But we have seen a couple times this season where they score in the final 5 seconds. They don't really, they haven't been out of very many games, maybe like 2 this season. Really, yeah, maybe just that Vegas game, that second Vegas game.
That's the only one that comes to mind for me.
Because even a lot of the multi-goal losses, they gave up an empty net goal later. There was one of them they gave up 2. So yeah, it really has only been 1. But you can tell there were games they should have been out of. You're down 3-0 in the third period. You shouldn't be in that game. They 100% believe they're going to come back and win these games right now.
Yeah. And it's fun the ways that it's happened to you. I mean, if you're going to script a way to come back from a 3-0 deficit for the second straight night, how about a shorthanded penalty shot? Or wait, was that the first game? Am I forgetting this now?
That was the first one.
That was the first one. Okay. Yeah. So let's talk about that. First of all, as an ability to come back, you get that chance and Christian Dvorak goes in and scores, you know, a shorthanded penalty shot goal, and suddenly there's a spark. It's just crazy the way things are happening right now, the way they're getting back in games.
That shootout move that he essentially used on the penalty shot too. I know people are like, okay, well, at some point the other team's going to know that's coming, right? A little, but I would say with back-to-back games against Anaheim, they knew it was coming because they saw it on the penalty shot in the first game. It's not the sort of move where if you know it's coming, you just automatically stop it. That's a difficult move to pull off, the backhand shelf breakaway goal.
I'm going to give people a little tease. I'm going to be doing something on Christian Dvorak next week. I'm not going to, it's part of a bigger feature, but I've already talked to Radim Verbata about that because it's nice. Essentially, I called it the reverse Radim the day after he did it. And I've talked to Verbata about that move. So he provided some insights. He's always great. So look for that coming next week.
I will look forward to that because it's, I think every Coyotes fan, as you're watching, you're like, wait a minute, I've seen this before. And it was just as effective when Verbata did it. It's not like he's going down there breaking out the Adrian Acoin slap shot from 15 feet away.
The closer.
Yeah, the closer. wanted to get your thoughts on this too, Craig. The game, the second game against Anaheim, where they came back from down 3-0 in the third, the Kessel goal we're talking about, Dvorak winning it in the shootout, although Aiden Hill actually had to make one last stop. Aiden Hill, we got to mention, I mean, coming in, making 14 saves. The save on Lundestrom in overtime was ridiculous. And Hill keeps downplaying it, saying that Lundestrom fanned on it. Maybe he did. It was still a ridiculous save.
A little behind him, but he still got enough on it to put it in the net. It was a really cool looking save. And my God, 14 saves in a relief effort. Your first action in, or at least in the NHL, in basically a year. That was a hell of an effort. And look, we knew the Coyotes were three deep at goaltending. They haven't shown it this year because Antti Raanta hasn't played nearly enough. But it was nice to see Aiden Hill come in. It's funny, Bill Armstrong had a funny quote on that. Because he said, you know, we've been telling these guys, you might play because of COVID. You know, you got to be ready. And he's like, all the guys are like, yeah. Like, never expecting it to happen. And then Aiden Hill gets thrust into that situation. And Bill says, you stay at the barbershop long enough, you're going to get your hair cut.
I feel like we have seen Aiden Hill in the past thrown into situations where you're like, man, that's got to be tough. And he has thrived. I'm not going to sit here and say, like, he's going to be a clear-cut, dominant number one goalie in this league for years and years. But he has the upside to be that guy still, in my mind, where, you know, however the Coyotes want to proceed with this going forward, if they move on from Raanta and they go with Kemper and Hill as the backup next year or whatever, I think that's at least in play. I don't know if he's totally ready for that. It depends where you think you are as a team. But I do like what I've seen from him, not just 14 saves, but I mean, now this is over the course of like a few years.
You know, you obviously worry, will he be claimed in the expansion draft too? Will he be one of the goalies taken? That's something that they have to worry about. I don't know what it's going to look like, what that market's going to look like. So it's premature to say that he would be the guy, but he'd certainly be on a list of guys to consider if Seattle's looking for a goalie.
The end of that game felt like, and you know, obviously the crowds are small because you can only have 25% max. The end of that game was the first time in a calendar year where I've been at a sporting event and felt the crowd when they won that game. Like there was a legitimate cheer where it was like, they just came back from down 3-0 and won in the shootout. It was the first time. Yeah. It was the first time since February of 2020 that I'm not even sure I felt it at a game then, but, I mean, it's cause I've been to a decent amount of sporting events in this last year, whether it's been Diamondbacks or even an ASU football game covering these, and there's no crowds at those. And there's not much of a crowd even at the Coyotes games, but they were into it by the end of that one.
They talked about that at the start of the year. They wondered how much even a small crowd would help the Coyotes. They've been boisterous. I'll say that about them. I've definitely noticed the crowds in the arena, even though we're talking between 2,000 and 3,000 fans. It's not a lot, but I've noticed them. Hey, what have you made of OEL's play since his comeback?
It's always, he's such a lightning rod now for criticism for whatever reason. I still think he can be better. There was one game in there, and we talked about this off the air. It was the second game back, and it was the second half of a back-to-back. His first two games were back-to-back against St. Louis.
After a break for an injury, yeah.
Yeah, which, as you pointed out, was his longest absence in his career to miss his NHL career to miss that many games in a row. But I think he's been good. I mean, he's at 8 points now in 9 games, so he is contributing offense. Rick Tocchet has made it abundantly clear he wants offense from his defense, whether that means guys activating up the middle of the ice even or getting the puck in from the point. OEL's very good at getting the puck in from the point. I know it's not a slap shot like Tocchet likes sometimes. It's more of just throw it in there and let it bounce around like a pinball. But he's producing offense. And the thing I'll say with OEL, he's always out there against the other team's top line. 95% of the time, he's out there. His primary responsibility is defending the other team's top forwards.
Yeah. I do, like I said, that one game he really struggled when he was alongside Ilya Lyubushkin, but I think his defensive game is sharpened of late. I still think his details can be better. His technique can be better, but you like the fact that he's producing offense. They need it desperately from the blue line. While he was out, it was Jacob Chychrun alone for a long stretch of that. And then Jordan Oesterle popped up at the last minute. I still think they need more offense from their blue line. Those three guys are doing it. Those three guys account for more than 90% of the points from their blue line. Yeah. Alex Goligoski is playing some brutal minutes right now too. He's getting a lot of defensive zone starts. He's on the PK. So that's a factor, but he only has one assist. If you're looking for a fourth guy, you know, to get your top four really contributing, they could really use a little more offense from Alex.
Yeah, because Nicholas Jalmerson's never really been an offensive contributor, and Jason Demers really hasn't been either. That's just not their game. But it is interesting that, and maybe it's a good thing, I guess, in some ways, if you're looking and saying, well, who are the guys providing offense? It's Jacob Chychrun, who's going to be here beyond this year. It's Oliver Ekman-Larsson, who's going to be here beyond this year. And it's Jordan Oesterle, who I would assume is going to be here beyond this year. You know, at least OEL and Chychrun are signed beyond this year. And I would think they're going to keep Oesterle around. So those are guys that you want contributing offense. If it was just all coming from Demers and Goligoski, you'd be like, we may have a problem here, big picture.
Yep. Yeah, no question.
We're going to get – oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, we're going to get questions.
We're talking over each other right now. You had mentioned the performance of the PK too, and I think that probably warrants a mention because they lost so much from last year, the personnel. Brad Richardson, of course, was signed elsewhere. They didn't re-sign him. Michael Grabner was bought out. Derek Stepan was traded, and then OEL was out of the lineup for 10 games, and yet this unit still ranked ninth in the NHL, which is really a testament to both, you know, the structure and the teaching that they've had, and then the personnel that have gone out there and filled in those roles.
Yeah, it's been remarkable to me what they had that stretch where they killed off 24 of their first 25 road penalties, which I mean, that's ridiculous, even if you've had the same group together for 5 years. But it has been remarkable to me that they were able to become a good penalty killing unit so quickly, because like you said, they lost a bunch of pieces off the PK in the offseason. And then they had injuries to guys this year, and not like guys have missed, you know, the whole season, but like didn't have Kraus for a while. You didn't have Hjalmarsson for a little bit in there, you know, even Christian Fisher. I know he's not contributing offensively, but he's part of the penalty kill. So to basically revamp your entire penalty kill and do it right away against Vegas and St. Louis, that's encouraging. Tyler Pitlick, I know he doesn't score a ton. I don't think they brought him in to score a ton. He's been solid.
Yes, he's been a good addition. He goes to the net. He got that deflection goal. He can carry the puck sometimes through the neutral zone too. So I think he's added quite a bit to this team, actually.
What do you think about them going to the net? I feel like it's pretty blatantly obvious that they're doing it a lot more this season.
Yeah. Did you see the Matty McConnell stat that I had in there? Matty McConnell's been charting the goals since the start of the season, where they're scored from. It's a pretty telling number, actually, when you look at where they're getting their goals. He has 72.82%. That's how precise Matt is.
Wow.
Have been scored from his grade A range, which extends from the low hash marks to the end boards. So that's a lot of goals being scored right in that prime area. Just over 20% more have been scored in the area from the low hash marks to the top of the circles. So you're basically getting nothing above the circles. You're getting everything down low.
Yeah.
That makes sense, right? You're not going to beat an NHL goalie clean from the blue line. I'm sorry. And you know, that whole idea about hammering slap shots from the blue line for deflection, sure, but sometimes a wrist shot's easier to deflect.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just get it on net.
We saw it. We've seen it firsthand with this team over the last few years. They, especially on the power play, would pass it around the perimeter and wait for the perfect shot, and then the power play's over and you're not scoring. And now they're doing something. It's a conflict, basically, because you look at it and you say, okay, well, yeah, you're going to the front of the net. It makes it a lot easier to score goals. I was talking to Shane Doan about this last week, and he's like, yeah, but it's not easy to go to the front of the net. And it's not just, okay, if you go there, you're going to get cross-checked and thrown around. It's also sometimes you have other responsibilities before you can go to the front of the net. Like, you may have a responsibility to go dig the puck out of the corner and get it to the point before you can even try to go through the just car wash of trying to get to the front of the net. The Coyotes are, it feels like they are, they are.
Have you been on the air yet?
I have not, actually. But that's what it's like. I mean, depending what team, some of these teams clearly don't have the defensive weapons and it's a lot easier, but some of these teams you're just going to get thrown around if you try and get there. And one of the most, if not the most encouraging things for me with the Coyotes this year is they are doing it. Rick Tocchet's been saying it for years. They have said, yeah, we got to do this for years, but they weren't able to do it. And it's not as simple as, okay, now we're trying. It's, you know, you're possessing the puck more in the other team's zone, so you're able to set up. But that has been, those are goals that you can keep scoring if you can get set up like that.
Yep. Yes, sir. You want to get to questions?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'll ask you one more, and I'm pretty sure this is in your story. How concerned are you about secondary scoring outside of the guys we mentioned that are scoring?
Very. I mean, they're still, you know, among the lowest teams in the league in goals per game. It's great that the short leash line is producing. It's great that Kessel is producing and Christian Dvorak has risen, but they're just not getting anything elsewhere in the lineup. I mean, they're Jacob Chychrun, of course, on the back end, but they're not getting enough goals from other guys. And I'm, you look, you're not asking for these guys to be 20 goal scorers. Maybe Lawson Crouse could have been in a full season if he had to hit so many posts, but you definitely need contributions from Lawson Crouse. When Pitlick's doing a little bit, you need more from Derek Brassard. I think you could use a little bit from Christian Fisher. Now, some of these guys have to just chip in with secondary scoring from time to time to boost you a little bit higher. Tuckett's talked for so long about getting that like 0.3 more goals per game. It makes such a difference in this league when you get that third goal, when you're averaging three goals a game. They got to find a way to get that. And I hate to single him out because I think he's been playing really hard and doing a lot of good things, but yeah, they got to get more from Lawson Crouse. They got to get some goals. They expected him to be a goal scorer of some note this year. Yet, you know, they thought he could be between on a pace for 15 and 20 goals in an 82 game season.
Yeah, it is a tough one. The post has not been his friend at all. Let's get into some of the – he's at least a guy that can affect the game in other ways, and he can play up and down the lineup, but you're right. They're going to have to get some offense from him, which he still can provide. I mean, he's – it's different when you are – when you're Phil Kessel and you get off to a slow start offensively. I think it plays in the back of your mind that, like, no matter what I do going forward, this is still going to be seen as a down year now. Whereas if you're Lawson Crouse, if he goes on a run here in the next 2 weeks where he has four goals or three goals – it's fine because he's doing other stuff, but he does need, they need some offense from him because Garland and Dvorak and Chychrun in particular, I don't know that you can ask much more from them, from what they're giving you right now.
No, they're, and the Coyotes would be too easy to defend if you're just talking about two lines. I also think, I don't know if it's going to happen. I think this team could use a third line center. They're getting killed on draws in some areas. And look, they wanted Barrett Hayton to be that guy. It obviously didn't pan out. He's not ready yet. And that's okay. As we've talked about, he's down in the AHL now, but if they're going to make a move, I think they might look at adding another center to this roster.
Okay, let's get into some of these questions. There's a few that revolve around this guy. So if I don't read your question specifically, I'm sorry, but I'm going to just go with Los Coyote Steve because it's the most straightforward. Have the Coyotes just about lost all patience with Ranta at this point? There's a lot of other questions in here about his future.
Yeah. I mean, let's be honest. How could you not at this point? He's played three games and he's had three injuries this year.
Yeah.
Every year he's been here, he has been injured. And I'm not saying this is Antti Raanta's fault. He may simply have a body that's not equipped to handle this sort of workload. That just may be reality. But yeah, it's become apparent that they can't count on him being healthy and being able to play. So, you know, I don't know, even know if they're going to be able to trade Antti Raanta at this point at the deadline. I don't know what you could get for a guy who's just not in the lineup. But in terms of his future, yeah, there's no way Antti Raanta's coming back next season.
We've talked about this in the past with him specifically because he's played three games this season, which means Kemper's had to start 16 of 19, which is too much.
Yes.
Even for Kemper, who plays better the more he plays, there's a limit. And I think maybe we saw that the other night. The thing that is so vexing about Raanta is two of those three starts were pretty much great. Like when he plays, he's very, it's so strange because it's like, okay, Antti Raanta starting tonight. Okay. I'm confident in what's going to happen in goal. Like he's very dependable when he's out there, but it's between the actual games. Really. You can't, as a number two goalie. And like you said, it's not his fault, but as a number two goalie, the coach has got to be able to look and say, okay, we need to go to Raanta. We got to be able to go to our number two. They've got back-to-back games against Colorado starting tonight. Mm-hmm. You know, that's when you need to be able to say, okay, we'll go with Kemper one and we'll go with Raanta with the other and probably say, okay, we'd like to start Raanta in the first one to give Kemper a little bit of rest. They don't have that luxury, which is tough because they have a great goalie and a very good goalie and an up-and-coming goalie, and yet they still only have two goalies.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a problem.
Okay. Let's go through some of these. Chris in Phoenix, 25th anniversary question. I always thought the Coyotes would have been better if they kept Solani rather than trading him to free up money needed to acquire Roenick. Solani was a better player at that point and going forward. Was it strictly a money thing? Was it a marketing personality thing?
It was both, actually. It was definitely a money thing, but they also wanted an American personality to market as they tried to build the franchise in this market. And let's be honest, JR was an unbelievable spokesperson for the team, public figure. He was amazing. He talked to everyone, had time for everyone, and it was genuine. He would engage people when he talked to them. So that as much as the money thing was a reason why they did it. If you're asking me if they would have been better with Solani, well, JR was still a really good player when he got here, but everybody knows he had that knee injury when he was playing in Chicago, he was never the same player after that. Like, JR was just electric before that knee injury, just electric when I watched him as a Blackhawk. He was still really good. Teemu Selanne was, he was just ridiculous when he went to the Ducks, just ridiculous.
When you watched him as a Blackhawk in 92, did they win the cup that year? I don't remember.
Hey, thanks for that.
Okay. No, it's tough when you're comparing somebody to Teemu Selanne. I mean, we're talking about one of the best players I've ever seen. So yeah, but Roenick, like you said, did a ton. Todd Walsh did a feature on him the other day on the pregame show, flashing back to the game seven against, game seven was against St. Louis, wasn't it? But Darian Hatcher was the one who broke his jaw. And I remember even at the time, I wasn't in Arizona yet, but I remember at the time being like, they basically told Roenick, okay, you cannot play, or you can play tonight, but we're going to have to cut some teeth out. And then cut to opening faceoff, and he's out there.
Yeah, and his jaw wired shut, having to breathe through his nose. That's, and he described it graphically for me when I wrote that story a while back of the things that he had to do to cope, including clear his nose. And then he literally made the sound of his breathing on the phone for me. It sounded like a horse.
All right. Let's see. Non-linear donut ball delivery. I love this count. Brandon Tanev's new role with the Penguins doesn't seem to be working out. Shocking. If you're Ron Hextall and looking at having to pay him through June 2025, how do you move him out? Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And why the Penguins shouldn't have paid him what they did in the first place.
They should hire, you know, is Rick Morin GMing somewhere?
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, to Rick Morin.
He will trade for Brandon Tanev.
Drum.
This is probably him. He's probably non-linear donut ball delivery. He's writing in just to troll me. This one's tough. Okay. Maybe it's not tough. Desert Doggies 96 writes in, if today you could trade Dvorak, Chychrun, and Garland for Austin Matthews, would you do it?
Wow. Dvorak would obviously have to be in that exchange because he's a center and he's a good one and you'd have to give quality, but wow. Ooh. Those are arguably, aside from goaltending, the three best players on your team?
Yes, the three best players on your team, and they're all young enough where you assume they're still getting better.
Yeah.
I'd probably
try and hang on to one of those guys. I'm not sure I'd go all three.
Somebody sent us the thing the other day. Did you see it? It was like Toronto media had caught on that Connor Garland was in the league, and they're like, oh, yeah, he'll fit on Toronto. We'll give you our eighth defenseman.
I know. I saw a couple of articles on that, and I didn't even bother addressing him. Like, really? Really? This is just absurd.
I know.
It all started because Elliot Friedman said they were going to target a top six forward. So yeah. Some people connected the dots. Oh, they'll just go get Connor Garland because, you know, he's going to want to get paid in Arizona. They're not going to pay him. And yeah, the Coyotes will absolutely give up their best forward right now for, you know, not much.
Yeah. Well, because it'll help Toronto.
First round pick. Let Toronto's first round pick, which will be
like 28th?
Yeah, at best, right? Right? Yeah. So you don't even know if that guy's going to pan out. Yeah, we'll give up Connor Garland for him. Sure.
Yeah, why not? The only thing when you trade, if you're trading your three best players, it'd be really hard to pass on Austin Matthews, and Toronto wouldn't do this trade anyway.
Yeah.
But the only fear there is if you're trading your three best guys, even though Matthews is the best player in that deal, obviously, because he might be the best player in the NHL this year, if you make that trade and Matthews gets hurt, you're just done because you've traded away the top half of your team for Austin Matthews. And then he doesn't play,
then you get into the lottery and get a high pick.
Yeah. Right. That's how it works. Right.
Oh yeah. That doesn't happen for the Coyotes.
No. Yeah. Ozzy has another question about Ronta. So at what point do we start looking for whoever is holding the Ronta voodoo doll? Here's one from Murdoch. Keep one, trade one, cut one. Kemper, Garland, Chychrun.
I saw that one too, and I was like, oh my God, no.
That is tough.
Okay, if we're forced to do this,
yeah,
if we're forced to do this because of their ages and their positions, I'm keeping Chychrun. I'm trading Garland because I think he can bring the most return, and I'm cutting Darcy Kemper, but that's not what I want to do.
This is where it works to our benefit to not be doing this show in a market like Toronto or Vancouver or Montreal, where if we said this, it would immediately pop up in blogs. Oh, Craig Morgan wants to trade or cut Darcy Kemper.
Says they should cut Darcy Kemper. Yes.
Yeah. Probably would have to agree with you because you're thinking at that level of you would get more in a trade for Garland than you would for Kemper just based on the contract position.
goalies just don't bring much in trades.
Yeah, and I don't think you could let Chychrun go because he's
number one defenseman, and you search a lifetime for those.
Oh, here's one from Michael. I know this is still up for debate, but where do you guys stand on the Schmaltz-Strom trade win? Also, is Craig excited to hear Stan Bowman claim this season as a success and that Chicago's rebuild is over? See if I can make a bell sound here. Oh, that's not bad.
Nice. That's good. Thank you for that.
I'm here for you.
The Schmaltz-Strom trade is one that I think has helped both teams. I think both teams would like more. But Nick Schmaltz is having a pretty good season. He's in a mini slump right now. This is the exact time Nick Schmaltz talked about this in the offseason, where he needs to break these sorts of slumps before they string into lots of games. He needs to be more consistent. He needs to keep producing. I think it's three games now without a point for him? He needs to put these to a stop and find a way to contribute to show that he can be more consistent. But he's been very good this year. As far as Stan Bowman, yeah, I don't want to talk about that anymore. But yeah, and you look at the Blackhawks now, you're like, oh my God, they're really good. Look at where they are in that awful division. Just an awful division. I told you Columbus was not going to be a good team this year. I told you Columbus. There are some bad teams in that division.
I'm pretty sure I told you Nashville wasn't going to be a good team this year. And they've played three less games than Detroit. But they also just lost to Detroit.
Nashville's sliding. Like Columbus, Nashville, and Detroit, I all had out of the playoffs. So it's just a matter of that next team. I don't know what's up with Dallas right now. We'll see what they're able to do as they get playing some more games and get a rhythm. But they don't look like themselves either right now.
They don't, but Khudobin looks really good in net. They just don't ever play. Like Dallas, for a variety of reasons, has had just chunks of games. They've only played 15 as we're recording this. Detroit's only 1 point behind Nashville. That is insane. And also, you know, Craig, Chicago's only 1 point behind Tampa. So maybe.
Yeah. I mean, Dallas's winning percentage is not good, though. It's point percentage. It's 533. The Blackhawks are at 619. They are fourth in that division. So I don't think that's going to last. I still think, you know, I don't know if Florida's going to keep up this pace, but they look like they're ready to make the playoffs. Tampa's obviously going to be in. I think Carolina's going to be there. So can the Blackhawks really edge out Dallas for that last playoff spot? In the end, I don't think it happens, but. Hey, if it happens, okay. Then they get to play Tampa in the first round.
That's the spirit.
That'll go well.
Let's see. What else do we have here? Coyote in Philly. Which fast food chain has the best spicy chicken?
Ooh. Spicy chicken?
Well, this is tough because Cane's doesn't have spicy chicken. So if you're looking for a distinctly, okay, spicy versus regular chicken, I think Cane's only has one chicken, right?
Yeah. Have you had Popeye's spicy chicken sandwich? It's pretty good.
Is it? I haven't had Popeyes in a while, but there's just not a lot of Popeyes around here, but last time I had Popeyes, it was very good. I didn't have the spicy though. So maybe I'll go with you on that.
That's a pretty good sandwich. Now, I mean, I don't know what qualifies as fast food, right? I mean, if we're down on that level, then yeah, I'm going to throw Popeyes in that level. If we're rising above, I'm not sure it's fast food, but on that level, Popeyes is a really good spicy chicken sandwich.
Wendy's spicy chicken nuggets are very spicy. And I'm somebody who doesn't notice the spice very often. Like it's got to be they're spicy. They will catch you if you're not ready for them. Yeah. I thought we had another food. Oh, here's a good one. Eldon writes in, Craig, what was your favorite part of being Turkish for a week? Did you try any fun Turkish foods?
No, I did not try any Turkish foods, but I was able to sell a lot of real estate. So
that's good. What I love about our listeners and your readers, and I know there's an overlap in the Venn diagram there. It was all sarcasm back to you. You just got a bunch of responses in Turkish. Jamie, when he on our text thread, made sure to take the time to text back to you in Turkish. I had looked up what the Natty Hattie was called in Turkish, but I couldn't pronounce it. So maybe next week.
Yeah, that was a brutal week.
Yeah, that I can't even imagine. Dave Henning writes in, it's two variations of the same question. For this season only, which defenseman in the Honda West would you rather have than Chychrun? And then taking into account age and contract, which defenseman in the Honda West would you rather have for the long haul than Jacob Chychrun? First of all, Dave, points for getting in the full sponsored Honda West division. I'm still struggling with that, but where are you going with that, Craig?
I'm not struggling with that at all. I don't want any part of calling those teams by their sponsor names.
That's fair. There's no struggle.
How about Cale Makar? Would he work?
Yeah, Cale Makar would work.
In both instances.
Yeah, that's fair.
He's spectacular.
He's a beast.
He is ridiculously good.
I don't know that there's a ton of other ones, though. If you're going for 1 year, yes, I could find some other ones. If you're going big picture, Chychrun would be off the top of my head behind Makar, probably. It'd probably be Makar and Chychrun.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Drew Doughty's obviously having a great season, but Chychrun's right there with him in points. So, yeah, he'd probably be my second choice.
Yeah, because
Cale Makar is good.
Yeah, he really is. And we're going to see Colorado. The Coyotes have seen everybody in the division now except Colorado and Minnesota because those games got postponed earlier. We're going to see Colorado starting tonight. You want to talk about a measuring stick for the Coyotes. This is the one team over the last, 2 years that there were a couple games towards the end of that playoff series where you're like, okay, we belong on the ice with them right now. Those two 7-1 losses to close out that series, or they both felt like 7-1 losses at least.
Yeah. This really is a test. And here's the other thing. Colorado hasn't been playing well. Did they lose their last game 6-2
to Minnesota
before Minnesota finished its road trip? So I'm guessing they're going to be ready to play tonight.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at this big picture, if you're the Coyotes, you kind of want Colorado beating all these other teams because you figure Colorado is a playoff team. So Colorado losing to Minnesota is not good. Now, obviously you need to beat Colorado. You don't want them to get right against you, but you need these other teams. You need Colorado, St. Louis, and Vegas. They can just go on a tear. That's fine. Just if you're the Coyotes, you're trying to be the fourth team in. And that doesn't mean you can't finish third or even second in the division, but just be aware at the end of the day when there's four teams in, Colorado, St. Louis, and Vegas are going to be three of them in whatever order.
Yeah.
Bobby Big Wheel. We haven't heard from him in a while. Do you think the Coyotes would trade for Sam Bennett? He fits a need for power up the middle, is a great playoff performer, and can add to the Coyotes' newfound grit, which is proving a successful strategy.
Where do you sit on Sam Bennett? I feel like Jamie should answer this question. He has a lot of thoughts on Sam Bennett.
He does, but they're all over the place. He was so angry when the Flames burned a year of his contract eligibility a few years ago. And then I believe last year he was like, that was a good move. They should have burned too.
He hasn't been a terribly productive player, but I mean, they definitely need help at center. I wonder if they'll look to address that at some point.
Yeah. If you're telling me Sam Bennett is available on cheap, I'd take a flyer on him, but I'm not giving up the pieces that I think most teams are going to ask for from the Coyotes. Like the maybe most encouraging thing about this Coyotes group this year is that it's the core guys for the most part that are, as you said earlier, that are really the ones driving this. I mean, that's why you draft guys and then and re-sign them. I mean, I've said on the show, I think they probably paid Keller too much, but I've also said I understand the thinking behind it. You're trying to keep your core together of guys you drafted. They have that. I wouldn't mess with the core unless I'm getting a really good return.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm trying to find.
Here's one. Go ahead.
Go ahead and read yours because I'm looking for one specific one.
Dave Henning, if you had to nominate Coyotes for the All-Star game, who would be your top three and in what order? I mean, Connor Garland's at the top for me. Jacob Chychrun is on that list. Number three guy? I don't know, actually. I'm not sure I have a third guy that would be All-Star level.
Maybe
Christian Dvorak.
Yeah, I'd go Dvorak. Kemper's been really good.
He hasn't been great, though.
No.
Playing too much.
His numbers, I mean, there are some games where he has taken over, but they really, actually, they haven't asked him to take over games as much this year, which is good. Craig is gone. Craig has left. I would probably go Garland, Chychrun, and Dvorak. I think that's fair. There's also a lot of times you get a goalie in just because of like the format of the game where they're like, oh, we got to fit a goal. The Coyotes haven't got to just have like a true all-star, I don't feel like, in a few years. They had Keller. Keller was an all-star in his worst year, probably. John Scott wasn't a Coyote when he was an all-star. Let's just get some actual Coyotes in there as all-stars.
Yeah, Garland and Chychrun are worthy this year.
Yeah. I think Dvorak probably is, too. It's tough at that position.
Yeah.
Let's go along those same lines. This is what I was looking for from Coach East Jack. How do you like Dvorak's chances of making the 2022 USA Olympic team or Keller or Schmaltz or Darcy Kemper in Canada?
Wow. I haven't given that thought or done enough analysis of the players that might be in play to answer that one definitively. That's why I was, some of these questions, like, I could write a whole story on this. I would really have to do some reporting to really get a sense of this. But
yeah,
I mean, if they keep progressing, they got to be in the mix, right?
The Coyotes should have some guys on Team USA. I think that that's maybe the best way to answer this question is, yeah, at the Olympics in 2022, because what was the lineup the other night, I was looking at this, I think 11 of their 18 skaters in one of the games were American. Like, the Coyotes are a very heavily American team.
Yeah.
And those aren't like fringe guys. I mean, most of those 11 are in there every night. So yeah, whether it's Dvorak or Keller or Schmaltz, Chychrun for sure, I would think. Kemper, it's obviously tougher to make the Canadian team. But if you look at all the best goalies in the NHL right now, a lot of them are Finnish or, you know, from other places in Europe. If you're looking at the best Canadian goalies, Kemper's probably is one or two, isn't he?
Well, I mean, let's see.
That's no guarantee he would make it.
I'm trying to think of the top goalies right now.
I mean, like last year, Rask, but obviously he's Finnish. I'll just say this. Kemper would be in the mix for sure because he's got to be on the very short list. Now, I don't.
Hunter Hellebuck's American, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd have to, again, I'd have to do analysis. I don't want to answer, just throw some stupid thing out there and then realize, yeah, that was wrong.
I'm going to throw some stupid thing out there and realize it was wrong. I think he would be on the very short list. Now, I do think it's tougher if, like, Carey Price hasn't been that great this year. If Carey Price was playing like Carey Price, he's going to make it because he also plays for Montreal and he's got a history of being great. Kemper toils in a little bit of anonymity when you're talking about forming Team Canada because he plays not just in the U.S., but in Arizona. But he's been really good now for a few years. Here we can wrap up on, here's a couple more we can wrap up on. Rebecca, what are realistic expectations for this season? Every time I think, wow, this Coyotes team is good, they lose a game and I think they should win and I'm depressed. It might be easier for my mental health to just lower my expectations.
Go ahead.
I mean, my expectations for this team this season haven't changed. I think they should finish in that 4 or 5 range in this division. I honestly believe they're better than Minnesota. Maybe LA is better than Minnesota, and that's the team you're competing with. I think this Coyotes team should be a playoff team. I don't know that I see them winning an opening round series against Vegas or Colorado, if that's what it comes down to. I'd love to see Coyotes Blues again for 7 games in the actual playoffs, and that's possible. But as I've said since the offseason, I think this should be a fringe playoff team.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And it'll be really interesting if LA actually keeps this up and stays in the mix.
Yeah. Here, we'll wrap up with Dangle Snipe Belly since we're pretty deep into this. Craig, do you get joy out of making people cry? I know what that's about.
Depends on the person.
Okay, that's fair. Luke, have you discovered any new and awesome food spots through the pandemic? No, I haven't been going to food spots, which is like my favorite thing to do. No, nothing new. And what do you think are the main driving factors for Clayton Keller suddenly discovering relatively what defensive play is?
I think it's playing on that line and Rick Tocchet laying it out for him, laying down the law, saying you want to stay on this line, you're going to have to do those things in order to do it.
Yeah, that's fair. I think we can. I mean, there's a lot of questions, Craig. We can keep going if you want.
It's up to you. I saw the one on which current Roadrunner is going to make the most impact from Desert Doggies 96. Which current Roadrunner will be the first to make an impact with the Coyotes? Hayton, Soderstrom, Yannick, other.
Whew. Good question.
It is a good question. I don't know. They're such different players, obviously different positions, different styles of games. Hayton's a center. Yannick has been playing some center down there, which is interesting to me. I haven't even asked about that yet. But I still see him as a power forward in this league. And then Soderstrom, obviously, they want him to be an offense-driving defenseman, run the power play. So, hopefully they all have an impact.
Yeah, I think it's very big for those three guys specifically. The Coyotes don't have the deepest prospect pool right now. And you know, to be fair, a lot of that is because their prospects for a while are up here on this team now. But they need to hit on all three of those guys. You know what I mean? Because after that, I don't know that you're talking about major impact guys. You might still be talking about NHLers. And, you know, certainly one or two more could emerge. But right now, those are the three guys. They all need to make an impact. I would say, I don't know what the timeline would be. They all need to make an impact within the next 3 seasons.
Yeah. Yeah.
and Hayton probably sooner than that, but not necessarily.
You would hope sooner than that with Barrett, since he's already had some NHL experience. You would hope with Hayton that it's just about playing one season in the A and then he's ready.
Yeah. This is from Snarky Penguin 44. Oh, okay. Well, we're probably on the same side. Is anyone going to stand up and punish those who continue to take cheap shots at Garland, starting with Getzlaff tomorrow? So this question's from a few days ago.
I think they are to an extent. You've seen them, you've seen fights for whatever those prove in a game. I think you've seen some guys standing up. I still think this team needs some more heft on the blue line. I know they were able to add it on the front end. It was harder to do on the blue line because they had all these guys under contract and they couldn't move them. But they could use a little more thump back there. Let's put it that way. They could use a guy in the system like Kevin Ball.
Yeah, they could. The series against the Kings really, I think, drove that point home for people, because the Kings very clearly came out and said, this 83 guy, we're just going to beat him up, basically. And it's tough to beat Garland up, because even if you have hurt him, he doesn't show it. Like, he just pops back up. But the Kings, especially in that second game, I think they crossed the line a few times, but that was clearly their plan. They were willing to take a 2-minute penalty if it kept the Coyotes' best offensive weapon from doing what he can do. So we'll see. Anaheim, I don't think, really got to do that as much. But you do wonder if other teams are going to see the blueprint that the Kings put out there. And honestly, the Colorado put out there in the playoffs last year. Yeah. But the counter to that is, I do think the Coyotes, with Bill Armstrong and Rick Tocchet, you have a guy like John Hayden, you already had Lawson Crouse. You've got some guys now that very clearly know, hey, if this guy gets knocked down, it's your job to go out there and make sure it doesn't keep happening. Yeah. That might be it. Yeah. There's a lot of people talking about napkin jummy. Yeah.
Okay.
As Rose, has Dvorak taken over using the patented Verbackhander?
No, that's just got it. Coming next week, Rose.
You already wrote back to Hot Hands, but you can say it here too. Any chance the Coyotes kick the tires on a guy like Cody Eakin?
I'll stand by what I tweeted. His underlying numbers are terrible, and it's not just about the team he's playing on.
Justin, here, we'll close. I promise we'll actually close on this one. Do the Coyotes have a problem with playing down to their opponent's level?
Yes. I think everyone will say that around there. Tocchet will say it. Armstrong will say it. Yeah. When you look at their performance against San Jose and Anaheim, yes, they fell behind. So it's probably fair to say that, but at least they got 3 wins against Anaheim in 4 games, and they got 3 out of a 4 possible points against San Jose. So they're getting the job done in the inning against those teams.
Yeah. And Big Tortilla, I did say we were going to answer his question.
Big Tortilla is back.
He is. He's back. The Coyotes are
Big Tortilla. We want to know.
Off doing Big Tortilla things, probably. The Coyotes are. Any interest in Tanner Pearson from the Coyotes?
I've heard those whispers, but we'll see. I mean, there's so much is speculative at this point. Again, I'll go back to the idea that if they're going to add something, I think they'll look to add a center, but we'll see how it all plays out.
Do you remember that 70s line that the Kings had with Carter and Toffoli and Pearson? Would you have ever thought in 2021 the only guy still there would be Jeff Carter?
No, it's crazy. Yeah, you might want Tyler Toffoli, huh?
Yeah, I'll take Toffoli over Pearson. I'll just go ahead and put that out there. But Pearson's interesting. He's not consistent, but he's a different dynamic. I mean, I would assume that's somebody you can get for cheap, and we have seen him be good, very good in this league. All right, that's going to do it for us, Craig. Thanks for doing this. Thanks to the listeners for writing in. Jamie, thanks for not being here. That's probably the person I should be thanking most. All right. For Craig Morgan, I'm Luke Lipinski. Thanks for listening to the Natural Hat Trick Podcast.